In the early 1970s, the University of Cape Town's Centre for Extramural Studies was especially busy. Alongside its annual summer school, first launched in 1950, it hosted two events of signal importance in South African literary history. The first, in 1973, was a conference on the Sestigers, a group of Afrikaans poets and novelists who had risen to prominence in the previous decade. The second, in 1974, was a conference devoted to South African poetry in English. At each of these events, which incidentally point us towards the multilingual nature of the South African literary field, the peculiar forces subtending this field came to the fore in explosive confrontations. At Poetry 74, the principal divisions of approach were between what Peter Wilhelm described in ironically exaggerated terms as the Stalinists, who promote polit lit, and the introspectives, who want purity, love, madness, landscape. As much as it was ideological and thematic, however, the confrontation between the two sides was also generational. As Willem put it, some writers went to Cape Town to devour their fathers. For those would-be patricides in search of the best meal, none of the participants would have seemed a more tempting prospect than Professor Guy Butler, who was then head of Department of English at Rhodes University, founding editor of the periodical New Coin, a highly regarded poet, and a serious scholar and promoter of South African poetry in English. And so it was that Mike Kirkwood, recently appointed as a lecturer at the University of Natal, selected Butler as his target and attempted to consume him in a paper that spoke of the urgent need to get beyond Butlerism. Butler, it seems, was caught unawares, and the confrontation with Kirkwood was thus rather one-sided. Nevertheless, the clash has taken on mythic proportions, read by any number of commentators as a moment in which the old guard, with its easy liberalism and its belief in the autonomy of art, was put to the sword, and the ground thus prepared for the full emergence of a new generation of authors who, regardless of their skin colour and background, would reject the staid conventions and practices of their predecessors in favour of a more committed literature. Amongst these, the most prominent included Stephen Gray, Bobko Dientsma, Christopher Hope, and of particular note, the so-called Soweto poets, Oswald Mtshali, Mongane Sorote, and Sipho Sepamla. As is often the case with legendary struggles, there was much about the encounter of Butler with Kirkwood that has been exaggerated. Nevertheless, it cannot be denied that a significant shift was then underway in South Africa's literary culture, with the consolidation of what we might call, after Pierre Bourdieu, a political principle of hierarchization or valuation, which coincided with an apparent hardening of the censorship regime, the birth of new publishing concerns and periodicals, and very broadly, the gradual eclipse of poetry by prose, and particularly by the novel. As late as 1973, with her first major metropolitan literary ward behind her, Nadine Gordimer could still observe, "I don't need any reminding of the levels of literature where poets sit on Kilimanjaro. That snowy crown is not within reach of everyone who wants to write." Yet the advancing decade would witness the conversion of any number of poets into novelists. Stephen Gray, Mongane Sorote, Sipho Sepamla, even J.M. Coetzee are examples. Within poetry itself, David Atwell has claimed there was something like a shift from lyric to epic, from a poetry of interiority and immediacy to one of exteriority, objectivity, and community. Doubtless these shifts were occasioned at least to some extent by political historical events. Peter Wilhelm noted, a little too laconically, "Very shortly after Poetry 74 came the April coup in Lisbon. To make a precarious point, both the coup and the conference came out of the conditions of Africa." What is of interest to note here is that, from Wilhelm's perspective, these conditions were advantageous only to, quote, "the prose writers, privileged to live in exciting times," as they say, to testify to the fabric of existence in one of the great conflict areas of the world, end quote. In the broadest terms, the 70s witnessed the intensification and limited success of decolonization, which in South Africa found expression in the Black Consciousness Movement and the student movement, which themselves culminated in the violence and suppression of the Soweto Uprising. Whatever the precise nature of the relationship between such events and the internal dynamics of the literary field, it remains the case that in a very real sense, Poetry 74 participated in and contributed to a dramatic change in South African literary culture. Certainly, Guy Butler and the poetry and poetics with which he was associated have never fully recovered from the bruising they received in the 1970s. Poetry itself seems to have remained subordinated to the novel and to the requirements of a kind of identity politics. Where practiced, its aims are often therapeutic rather than artistic, a means of giving expression to and thereby healing the self. Its critical capacity for truth seems seldom to be recognized, except by those few brave souls who have continued to struggle against a general lack of interest. And yet, was it ever poetry, or even a kind of poetry, that was attacked? Was it to Butler's verse or his ideas about verse that Kirkwood objected? In fact, and this seems largely to have gone unnoticed by the many commentators, hardly if at all. For in each of the accounts, what is emphasized is the attack itself and what this says about conflict in South Africa and how unpleasant the conflict was and how surprising and so on and so forth. And what those who defend Butler usually do, and this includes Butler himself, is reflect on the hostility of the attack, on the lack of sophistication or novelty in Kirkwood's positions, and on the tendentiousness of his reading of Butler's verse. But what is hardly ever observed is that Kirkwood was not interested in the poetry itself, or even in Butler's ideas about poetry. What he was interested in was an ideological position he believed could be identified across Butler's entire oeuvre. His judgment of Butler's verse, in other words, was based from start to end on political rather than aesthetic criteria. Kirkwood's paper, The Colonizer, A Critique of the English South African Culture Theory, begins, quote, "Beyond Butlerism, we wish to indicate the preliminary line of an argument which, without giving the impression that a live human target is what we have in our sights. In Professor Butler's descriptions of the English South African writer's cultural orientation, we recognize assumptions, attitudes, a cast of mind, a consciousness which is thoroughly representative of the group he speaks for. To this we may add that in Professor Butler, South African English poetry found its editor." Thus, a critique of Butlerism becomes not an assault on an erroneous view of English South African literature, but an attempt by English South African writers to cultivate a self-awareness sufficient to generate the possibility of self-transcendence, end quote. What does Kirkwood's critique of Butler find? A series of sins, major and minor, including the proliferation of colonizer stereotypes and a nostalgic loyalty to 1820 and English heritage, which blunts the most dependable tool in fashioning an adequate self-awareness, these are Kirkwood's words, historical sense. But above all, Kirkwood finds an erroneous understanding of the place and role of white English speakers in South Africa, which locates them as a kind of buffer and mediator between two patriarchal tribalisms, African and Afrikaner, and also between two traditions, the local and metropolitan, African and European. It is to this idea that Kirkwood objects above all, arguing that Butlerism's central thesis of an identity crisis threatening white English speakers is ideological through and through, not least because it obscures the truth of the Manichaean innate structure of South African society. In fact, argues Kirkwood, the notion of an identity crisis entirely mystifies the true position of the Anglo-South African, who has been outmaneuvered by the Afrikaner and abandoned by the metropole. There is no identity crisis. There is only an anxiety about power, and there is no middle ground, only a portion of the dominant class who will be the velvet glove to cover the iron fist. But what purchase ought Kirkwood's criticisms to have? How far do they touch Butler's poetry? How far do they touch his poetics? In truth, the claims Kirkwood makes are directed largely at a straw man, concocted of cuttings from a poem or two, and a few of the essays stripped out of their context. Nor is he very much concerned to elaborate his own sense of what a committed poetics might be. For while it is clear to him that being a colonizer in the world seems an intolerable situation, when he asks the pressing questions, is there anything we can do about it? And if there were, what would that make us better poets and better critics? His answer is only, quote, "Art for liberation should indeed be the theme of the colonizer writer. The attempt to realize such a program in the arts will demand, we contend, self-transcendence in the colonizer writer, just as it will in the colonized writer. We stop short of advocating the techniques of that transcendence, but we point out that a life technique, as well as an art technique, will be required." Thus, what we find at this critical juncture, which has played no small part in influencing the shape of South African literature, is a speaking at cross purposes, a failure to get clear about what was at stake, and thus a missed opportunity to think about what poetry is and what poetry does, about why it might be important that poetry exists and why it might be problematic that it wanes. Of course, these are very large questions, and I don't intend to tackle them head on here. Instead, by way of clearing space, I wish to return to this moment to look more carefully at what Butler was saying and what he was doing. For in Guy Butler, South African poetry not only found its editor, as Kirkwood rather dismissively suggested, but also an astute critic devoted to thinking carefully about its particular conditions and its particular tasks and challenges, as well as a poet committed in his own quite idiosyncratic way to the notion that poetry is a way of knowing the world. Above all, what makes Butler interesting and especially relevant to this conference is his conviction that the South African English language poet, though an inheritor of a metropolitan literary tradition, was nevertheless confronted by peculiar challenges and demands, by a set of materials affected as much by aging as by translocation. Okay, before continuing any further, I'd like to read a poem, one of Butler's earliest, Servant Girl. "Neat swallows on smooth blue rocks, about whose contours pearl pale amber waters, a causa girl washing a white girl's cretin frocks, and singing a song more integral with rain-rinsed sky and sandstone hill than any cadence rung from my taut tongue." Perhaps the first thing to say about this poem is that, written in the 1940s and revised in the 1950s, it seems rather conventional. The quatrains and end rhymes, the contrast between three and four stress lines, all hint at common measure lurking in the background. And the pastoral scene with its solitary figure in the midst of nature and its contrasting colours, blue on amber, black on white, and textures, smooth rock against rough cretin, contribute to an easy lyricism, which is then restrained in the introspective and reflexive gesture of the second stanza. Not that it makes it a bad poem. On the contrary, in its own small way, it seems rather fine, delicate, melodious, with a neat modulation and line length, rhyme scheme, and stress distribution, engendering its effect and meaning. Indeed, there is nothing in its shape that seems arbitrary, for the ABBA pattern of end rhymes and the longer lines of the first stanza throw into relief the double rhyming couplets of the second stanza, and in particular the heaviness of the final two lines, each with their three prominent stresses, contributing to the somber, reflective mood of the poem's ending and giving special weight to taut tongue, the phrase in which the entire poem seems to pivot. One consequence of this heavy stressing is a slowing down, which gives more time to appreciate the pun on taut. This tongue, which is an organ of speech but also speech itself, is not only tense but also educated, the product of a kind of formation. In fact, the poem seems to suggest the two meanings of the word taut are connected. Tension, perhaps even anxiety, are consequences of education, which removes the poet from that immediate relationship with nature that is apparent in the singing of this solitary girl. On the other hand, set against this appreciation of an immediate response to and being with the natural world is the sense that only with self-consciousness that follows from education, which makes my tongue both taut and taut, can one meditate on man's place in nature. The prompt to this realization is the disturbance occasioned by the movement from the fifth line to the sixth, integral with, a surprise of syntax since integral does not often take with, and the problem of integration is thus dramatized by enjambment and then hinted at again with the rhyme on hill, not only because there is a lack of visual rhyme, but also because the oral rhyme depends on a slight deadening of the vowel in hill. Thus, at the last, there seems a recuperative gesture, insofar as the non-reflexive immediacy of the song may only pretend to integration, and must in any case remain ignorant of what the poem itself knows, which is that an understanding of man's place in nature in fact requires self-consciousness. Here, for the time being, we might pause our reading, having offered an interpretation of Butler's poem as one amongst a slew of variations on a theme, an instance which seems to add only the local colour of the Eastern Cape. What we have is the entirely familiar contrast between the shepherd's or shepherdess's easy song and the poet's contrived verse, a contrast that communicates the gains that come with the loss of innocence. Set alongside the poetry of metropolitan predecessors and contemporaries, Wordsworth, Yeats, Eliot, Pound, Auden, it unmistakably harks back to a late romantic sensibility and is at best unadventurous. At worst, the heavy stresses of its final lines seem banal, even melodramatic. In this short lyric poem, which appears to affirm the priority of the musical qualities of verse, its association with song and with cadence, these ponderous beats have an unwelcome leaden effect. The question, and it's one of the questions that the workshop asks, is whether it is ever appropriate to read a poem in this way. That is, to begin with a portable tool set provided by practical criticism and a general sense of the great poets, present and past, and then proceed to interpretation and judgment. In fact, the question we face here goes beyond this. For in the case of South African, and I imagine Australian literature, we are dealing with fields that, though they retain a complex relationship with metropolitan traditions, nevertheless have their own dynamics and pressures, their own histories and materials, and thus their own criteria for success and failure. This is undoubtedly something that Butler understood, and often articulated with real clarity. Transplantation in space, he says, to a different hemisphere, climate, and landscape might be expected to call for some change at least. Language feels the strain of space as well as time. More pertinent still is the following observation, in which the emphasis is less on landscape and language, and more on the reconfigured relationship with metropolitan literary traditions that arises as a consequence of the distinct artistic problems faced by local writers. Quote, "By virtue of the language that I use, whatever I write is a contribution, good or bad, to the literature in that language, but not necessarily of that country. This literature in English is great and sets mercifully high standards, which should prevent us from becoming isolated, uncritical, and provincial. But we must face the fact that some of the things we have to say may call for a style which is very different from the current metropolitan Alexandrian. I am frankly more concerned with the new thing that might come out of Africa than with the old masterpieces of Europe." End quote. In fact, local conditions are what determine, at least in part, which masterpieces of Europe will be preferred, ensuring an alignment with metropolitan poets deemed relevant and a sceptical distance from those whose concerns are less easily translatable. Thus, Butler chooses Wordsworth over Coleridge and says that, poetically speaking, he would rather be damned with rather be damned with Eliot than saved with Yeats. I got that totally wrong. He would rather be damned with Yeats than saved with Eliot. More significantly, however, this recognition of the demands of the local follows from and leads back into an awareness of those of one's predecessors and peers identified as similarly positioned and preoccupied. In Butler's case, it led to a series of undertakings that were ultimately constitutive of the South African literary field as a field. For in his scholarship and criticism and through his work as editor and anthologist, he was in no small part responsible for giving South African literature some of its institutional underpinning and thus its objective existence. Of the great many undertakings during Butler's lifetime, the ones that are immediately relevant to us here today are those essays and lectures he published between 1949 and 1960 and the 1959 Oxford Book of South African Verse, which he edited. for it is these texts that allow us to reconstruct the various positions in the South African literary field, and thus its struggles and stakes, and also to clarify what Butler understood as the peculiar tasks and challenges of the South African poet. In this reconstruction, we aim to make explicit what Ben has identified as the context of intelligibility. Okay, so the tasks of the South African poet. Butler identifies three. First, he thinks that a South African poet has to make South Africans aware of their environment. They have to see it more clearly, or simply see it. The five senses, he says, must be trained. Second, the South African poet must make South Africans aware of themselves. Finally, the South African poet must humanize the landscape and environment. Clearly, the first two tasks having to do with consciousness are closely related. In fact, Butler often implies that an awareness of environment is only the preliminary step towards an awareness of self, as when he suggests that a really popular poetry, narrative and descriptive, might do something towards making people aware of the objects and the people among which they live. Such an awareness, he says, is a prerequisite for any profounder use of them in poetry. As for the third task, the task of humanizing Africa, the landscape and the environment, I think this is a little trickier to pass. But what Butler seems to mean is that man cannot know his environment and thus cannot know himself without first accommodating himself to that environment, without imbuing it with a humanity, or at least with a range of associations and intimate resonances that ensure its hospitality. So, for example, he claims, Western man can normally only commune with a nature which has been partially tamed, just as in frontier life, so in art. Neither a beast nor an experience is tamed until it has an acceptable name. In the later essay, he asks, how are the objects and places of Africa to be clothed and humanized but by poetry, by conscious speech? These tasks, which are obviously not unproblematic, are directly related to what Butler conceives as the challenges and failures specific to South African poetry. They are related, in other words, to the state of the field and the condition of the materials, that is, to a set of position takings, which consist primarily of distinct works, groups of works and movements, and to an agglomeration of subject matters, techniques, forms, genres, and so forth. From early in his career, Butler's most fervent complaints are directed against the lack of precision, the tendency to vagueness, and the resort to affect in South African poetry. Most of our poets, he says, are attempting too much, pretending to a prophetic or sapphic vein they do not possess. Very few have been taught that poetry is not written with ideas or fine feelings, but with words. Elsewhere, he insists that the fault of nearly all South African verse is that it is written on the assumption that poetry is good according to the intensity of feeling in it. Poetry must be passionate, adoring, melancholy. In other words, the art is essentially romantic and moody. It is this, he believes, which engenders a tradition of nebulous religiosity, which revels in the lack of anything definite. Vague, dim, strange, vast, mystic, boundless, are favorite adjectives in much early South African poetry, he writes. In this sort of writing, no particular object is brought into a clear focus, and hence no troublesome proper names or precise epithets are needed. Indeed, nameless itself becomes a popular epithet. To these more general sins, he adds a catalogue of technical failures, a clumsy adherence to rhyme scheme, archaism, borrowed imagery and language, used simply for the purposes of ornament, and often in the service of themes of a maudlin romanticism. Sometimes, Butler comments rather archly, love, loneliness, and the felt all combine to produce a masterpiece of clichés, second-hand imagery, incredibly bad rhymes, and archaisms. Beyond bad technique and bad subject matter, however, there is a further problem in the materials, both poetic and raw, which are inadequate, principally because the English language poet in South Africa lacks stories which are her own, myths and legends, ballads and folk tales, as well as those images and symbols in which these stories are given a highly condensed form, lacks, moreover, the proper words, and above all, words that resonate with meaning. This again is a theme to which he repeatedly returns. Quote, the South African poet finds current English poetic diction charged with the wrong sort of electricity, finds words missing or new images that don't go with the old. And if he is not writing about landscapes or people, but on some universal theme, he may feel that he is forcing an accent, assuming a false sophistication. End quote. But here's another one. The mimosa, the protea, the aloe have been out of the artistic orbit till now. None of our plants have a European literary history. None have been loaded with meaning like the olive, the oak, the hemlock, the yew, the daisy, the daffodil, the rose. In a sense, because language, sensibility, and association have not been using them, looking at them, consciously employing them, in a sense, they are still alien. End quote. If the South African environment remains alien, the South African remains unconscious. More problematically, because South Africans encounter in literature only worlds from which they are disconnected, they regard literature as inherently fantastical, having little, if anything, to do with reality, which becomes the big stick with which to beat artists. And if they are skeptical of art, there are consequences also for the soul. Quote, the child becomes conscious of a cleavage between the world of his imagination and the world of school, parents, homework, streets, and cafes. If the cleavage is too sudden or sharp, he may renounce the world of image and myth as bunk and try to be unimaginative, insensitive, and tough. Somehow he must be made to feel that the world of his imagination, although not real in the sense that a bicycle is real, is not complete nonsense, is not in cloud cuckoo land, but has meaning. Somehow the ability to wonder must be preserved while the ability to notice and criticize grows. End quote. From all of this, it follows that in speaking of the techniques, or rather the tools of the poet, Butler gives special weight to those which enhance its descriptive and narrative qualities, those which make it less the trumpet of a prophecy and more a precision instrument, a means of introducing clarification into what he calls the dark, disorderly jungle of steel, race, and elephant grass. Thus, while he acknowledges early on that one of his most important indispensable tools is that linking and likening process, which we sort out under various headings, simile, metaphor, allegory, paradox in the field of imagery, and alliteration, rhyme, onomatopoeia in the field of sound, he ultimately attaches far greater weight to lexical, visual, and narrative elements than to prosodic and broadly generic elements. His concern is with the field of imagery, in other words, rather than the field of sound. And this is borne out in each of his essays and lectures, where the critical terms that recur are image, symbol, myth, diction, idiom, tone. In giving so much room to Butler's writings and talks, I've been trying to sketch the field in which he wrote and the materials he had to hand, from which issued forth particular demands. By way of illustration of this field and these materials, we might consider very briefly one of those poems that Butler regarded as exemplifying the most egregious failures of local verse. The Felt. Sun-drenched vales and circling hills and peace, and for a while life's driving forces cease to urge and all is still, and through the trees all noiselessly a hesitating breeze creeps softly by. In fact, I won't read it all. I'll let you glance over it. What is there to say? Clumsy rhymes, quelled and felt, clumsy inversions, making glorious the thoughts, an effusion signalled in the five exclamations, the magnitude and loneliness of the felt as vehicle of insight into self, nature, and God, and worst of all, no one thing described with any precision, and most things described with words that have entirely the wrong resonance. Sun-drenched vales, circling hills, peace, hesitating breeze. This, in all its parts, is what Butler conceived as failure, and what he therefore wrote against. And once we have understood this, and understood, moreover, that Butler's sense of good verse and bad, successful and inadequate, followed from a deep and thorough immersion in South African poetry, that his project was neither a writing after nor a writing back, our reading of his own work must change. How so? Let's return to Servant Girl, keeping in mind Butler's own sense of poetry's tasks, tools, and problems, and his irritation with what he regarded as vague, moody, romantic lyricism attached to themes of loneliness in the midst of nature. If we do so, what becomes apparent, to me at least, but I hope also to you, is first, that the poem is characterized throughout by a certain restraint and poise, which keeps affect at bay. Second, that it aims at the accurate employment of language to express a precise image or idea, those are Butler's words, evidence of which we find in the modifiers smooth blue, pale amber, causa, cretin, sandstone. And third, that the poem is an effort not of the voice, or not only of the voice, but of vision, of image making, indeed of that linking, likening process in the field of imagery that Butler invokes. For the action of the first stanza, the washing, becomes the basis for description found in the second stanza. The sky has been rinsed by rain. The cadence of the poem has been wrung from the poet's tongue. And this is anything but a casual metaphor. The poem, after all, and in spite of the idyllic vision upon which it enters and the introspection to which it resorts, is about a servant girl whose status is a function of and communicated in her labor. And in making of her activity a metaphorical resource out of which to characterize both the natural occurrence, rain, and poetic craft, verse making, Butler not only centers and prioritizes this washing, but suggests that if there is anything integrative with which the poem is concerned, it is precisely this girl's labor. It is washing this frock, in other words, which makes her integral with the rock and with the sandstone hill and with the rain-rinsed sky. And if the girl's labor is integrative, then the poet's labor might also be. At least, this follows from the association of washing and crafting, particularly since the act of wringing is also an act of hardening and condensing, so that the tautness of tongue suggests not so much an anxious self-consciousness, but a tightening, a process by which the tongue is made more receptive and resonant. Taut is thus a function of restraint, rather than a tension that comes from learning. Perhaps it seems that I'm making too much of imagery and image-making. To convince you otherwise, we might look at an earlier version of this poem and reflect on the changes that Butler thought necessary to bring it to completion. Neat swallows and smooth blue rocks about whose contours pearl, sweet amber waters, a Bantu girl washing a white girl's cretin frocks, and singing a chant which seems more integral with hill, water, and the sun than any harmony or interval from my taut tongue. With regard to the reading I've been proposing, the following revisions seem especially significant. The ABAB common measure rhyme scheme of stanza 2 is replaced with the double rhyming couplets. The number of stresses in the penultimate line are reduced. Chant becomes song. Harmony and interval, both more obviously musical technical terms, become cadence. Taut, T-A-U-T, becomes taut, T-A-U-G-H-T. The two metaphorical instances are introduced, which use the girl's washing as a source domain to characterize the actions of nature and of the poet, and that's probably the most important one. I mean, this is where we see the image-making happening. Thus, Butler foregrounds the labor of the servant girl whilst at the same time de-emphasizing the contrast between immediacy and self-awareness, natural and learned capacities. The poem, therefore, is offered as the outcome less of education than of a tightening, a wringing and a squeezing out, which is itself conveyed in the restriction on syllables and stresses that is so obvious in the final version, in which we come to feel this process in the movement of the final lines and the rhyming couplets. Craft becomes a kind of labor, and without any guarantee of success, labor becomes a means of integration, not only with the landscape, but with human beings in the landscape, including those whose own labor places them at a remove from the poet. So it is against the impulse to effusion, lyricism, and abandonment to love and solitude in the empty felt that Butler writes a poem that speaks of a drive towards precision and association, seeing and thinking. It suggests what he describes in his introduction to the Oxford Book of South African Verse as the conscious selection and development of a symbol. And it is related to his conviction that only in finding the right image, an image which is a clear reflection of ourselves in the world and the world in us, do we achieve, however briefly, a homecoming. And what we find upon this homecoming is that the labour of washing integrates girl with landscape, but only the labour of poetic craft perceives this integration and recognises its own integrative efforts as at once vital and stalled. Integral with never ceases to jar. Not least because washing precludes poetic craft and vice versa. Nor are labour and colour in any sense neutral. The black girl washes the white girl's frock when the poem is first published with apartheid on the horizon and continues to do so in the aftermath of its arrival. There is, however, a change in descriptor from Bantu in 1947 to Fingo in 1952 and then later on to Khoza. A change that is from a very broad category, Bantu, to a highly localized one, Fingo, but also from a word found increasingly in the documents and laws of the National Party to one that recalls a different set of relations, colonial no doubt, but invested nonetheless in mutual assistance. Thus, precision, finding the right word with the right resonances, is a means also to a judgment on the emergent racist dispensation, and the historicity of the poem itself causes to flicker possibilities of coexistence, now extinguished by apartheid. Thank you.